From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
This week on the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
The President-elect of the United States, Barack H. Obama.
After President Obama's inauguration and Rick Santelli's infamous rant on CNBC in February of 2009, disgruntled conservatives began raucous protests in opposition to bank bailouts, taxes, and what they perceived as the over-intrusiveness of the federal government. And the Tea Party surge helped the GOP take back control of the House in the 2010 midterm elections. But it's also been responsible for a slew of unelectable Senate candidates. Sharon Engel in Nevada, Christine O'Donnell in Delaware, Joe Miller in Alaska, and Richard Murdoch in Indiana, who won the GOP nominations over more moderate candidates, only to lose in the general election. One of the most visible of the Tea Party organizations is the Tea Party Express, which became nationally known after several national bus tours and co-hosting a presidential debate with CNN. The chief political strategist for the Tea Party Express, Sal Russo, is our guest.
We'll also hear from Mike Valines, former Republican State Assembly Minority Leader, Justin Stoner, District Director for the current Republican Minority Leader, Connie Conway, and Paul Hurley, former editorial page editor with the Visalia Times Delta.
The Tea Party. Are the reports of its demise premature?
From Fresno, the Matty Report, with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. A familiar political operative in California for decades, our guest Sal Russo is now known nationally as the Chief Political Strategist for the Tea Party Express. A quick editor's note, Sal Russo is a longtime friend, was a longtime friend of Senator Ken Matty, is currently on the board of directors of the nonpartisan Matty Institute. Well, welcome back to the Matty Report.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about the 2012 election. It seems like a lot of folks were genuinely surprised at the results. Obama won in an electoral landslide. Governor Brown was able to win voter approval of a new tax. The Democrats won a supermajority in both houses of the California legislature. From your perspective, was there any part of the Republican message that was a problem?
Well, first, I think you have to keep in mind, at least nationally, the election was very close. What happened is that it broke towards the Democrats at the end, and so they won everything that was competitive.
So they won 8 of the 9 states that were competitive.
I think it's something like 260,000 votes had shifted. Romney would have been elected president. If it's like 300,000 votes in the Senate that shifted, the Republicans would have gained 6 instead of lost 2. So it really was a close election nationally. One thing that people are forgetting is that the last time that, other than Ronald Reagan defeating Jimmy Carter, the last Democratic incumbent that was defeated for re-election was Grover Cleveland in 1888. I mean, you just don't beat incumbent presidents. That's a rarity. We had it happen a couple of times in recent times, so everyone thinks, oh, that happens all the time. It's really tough to beat an incumbent. And we had consumer confidence on the economy going up. I think 5 straight months consumer confidence was up. Obama's positives were edging up, got to 50%.
So it wasn't the message, was it the messenger?
Well, I think it's just difficult to ever beat an incumbent, first and foremost. Now, secondly, is, you know, when
Well, it wasn't just that race. I mean, the Democrats picked up seats in both the House and the Senate. And as well, California, that may just be a situation where California is a very blue state, but still.
I think the dynamics in California are a little different than nationally. Nationally, I mean, we lost 8 seats, the Republicans lost 8 seats in the House, but that was on top of a 67-seat gain 2 years ago. So the House is conservative today, maybe a touch more conservative than it was before the election. As I said earlier, the Senate would be up 6 Republicans instead of down 2 with a shift of 300,000 votes. So very, very close. And when the president gets reelected like that, I mean, you're just going to have the dynamics work that you had a little bit of a Democratic edge nationally.
So the Electoral College was a little large, but you're saying the popular vote was just closer than that?
It was close. It was really close.
Okay. I think I saw the number we were talking earlier. I think the number I saw that Romney got 47% of the vote, which is kind of ironic, but and Obama got 52% or something. But let's talk about the method of reaching the voters. Was that a problem? Did the Democrats simply have a better ground game?
The Democrats did have a better ground game. I mean, the decision the Obama campaign made, which ended up being the right decision, which was to forget about, I'm going to work with both parties, I'm going to be in the middle, which was messaged in 2008. his campaign in 2012 was right after all the key voter groups he was after. So it was minorities, single women, young people. There was no pretense that he was going to be the president for everybody. He was going to be the president for 50% plus one. So their whole get out the vote system and their whole messaging was geared to specific voter groups. And it worked very effectively. And so when you look at the demographics of who voted in 2012, it was uncharacteristically high in those demographic groups that Obama targeted.
The same as 2008, in essence.
Same thing in 2008, which nobody expected because of the fact that there's the aura around Obama is gone. He's now seen as a mortal, which he wasn't seen in 2008. And the Republican plan, which was tied to a computer system that collapsed. And so we actually had
few. I thought he was a business person, though, so that's kind of ironic again.
He was, but apparently some of the campaign weren't very businesslike. So it ended up being a colossal failure. And so I've seen conflicting numbers on it, but certainly in a lot of states, the vote for Romney was even lower than the vote for McCain. So there was certainly some misfunction in the dynamics of the turning out vote. So there was something that did go wrong. But the bottom line of it is that it's difficult to beat an incumbent president. And if you do, you need a candidate that's really able to connect with people. And Mitt Romney, who I think would have been a terrific president, never quite made the connection. Part of it was during that period of time after the primaries when Romney was the nominee, but before he could start spending his general election money after the convention, the Obama campaign went out there and really pounded him negatively in every key state. Okay. And they ran his negatives up so high that by the time the campaign started in September, he never could overcome that. He could never get that connection to the American public ever again.
Okay, when we come back, more on the 2012 election. Welcome back. We're talking with Sal Russo, chief strategist for the Tea Party Express. There were some visible losses by the Tea Party in the last election, Alan West and Joe Walsh. Do you think that the results of the election indicates voter fatigue with the Tea Party?
No. I mean, we won 67 seats, I think, in 2010. We held almost all those. We won some key Tea Party victories this time, Mark Meadows in North Carolina, Ted Yoho in Florida. So I think the Tea Party is going to be stronger in this Congress than it was in the last Congress. But here's the thing that to remember. I think people get distracted by the name Tea Party. What the Tea Party Express stands for is opposition to the increased spending, the intrusiveness of the federal government, and the skyrocketing national debt. I mean, that's what the Tea Party stands for. So whether you say you like the Tea Party or you don't like the Tea Party, 70% of Americans think spending's out of control, the deficit is way too high, and we have an unsustainable debt. So I think on the principal issue that the Tea Party stands for, I think all the candidates were talking about it in 2012, even more so they were in 2010. You can't find a Democrat that says, hey, let's expand the government and raise taxes, and, well, Obama kind of says that, but there's hardly a Democrat that says that. Everybody says this is a serious problem.
Well, Congress has had historically low approval ratings, and there's a lot of voter frustration over last summer's stalemate on the debt ceiling. Do you think that played at all into the results of the 2012 election?
I think there's frustration with both political parties. I don't think that one party is particularly, you see the polls change, that they'll blame the Republicans in Congress or the president or somebody for not getting it done. I think it's a system-wide complaint. I mean, it's true in California. It's true nationally. People want things done. They don't really care how the sausage is made. They want a sausage on a roll with some mustard on it, They don't care about how it gets done.
That's an interesting way to phrase it. They do say, like, legislation's like making sausage, so good analogy. What about this the cracks in the wall that are appearing with Grover Norquist's no tax pledge? Some high-profile Republicans are beginning to back away from that. Do you think such a pledge is a good idea, or is it too restricting as kind of a one-size-fits-all approach to public policy?
We've taken the position at Tea Party Express that, we're not going to get caught up in the symbolism, that we're going to worry about the substance. So kind of this bluster about being for the pledge, against the pledge, I mean, I'm not sure that that's particularly relevant. What we do care about is destructive economic policies that will make the growth in their economy worse, that will provide less opportunity for people. That's what our goal is. And so if you want growth in this economy, you have to maintain low tax rates, and you have to unburden some of the the regulations that have been crippling the economy. And that's all I got to say to somebody. If you've financed a home recently and see the volume of forms that you fill out and you have no idea what you're signing, and that's what they're saying, oh, well, we're helping you out with all that regulation, I think almost anybody who's been through that knows that's nonsense.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. What do you see as the number one takeaway from the 2012 elections?
I don't think that there was a strong message because people voted for this for, out of frustration for the same because they didn't know what to do. There wasn't a good, clear choice. When you listen to what people said about the difference between the economic policies of Barack Obama or Mitt Romney, they couldn't distinguish the two. So we didn't have that contrasting election that we should have had. I think that's a fault of the, one fault of the Romney campaign. They didn't make clear what their economic policies were.
What about the demographics? And a lot of people are talking about the impact of Latinos or of women or of young people or Asians. They all broke, as you indicated earlier, they all broke for Obama. Was that a big takeaway? Maybe that the Republicans are not reaching them?
You know, when you lose an election, you know, you have to look at how do you expand your base everywhere. I mean, that's certainly, I mean, I know when we ran Governor DuMaging's campaign, he won by, I think, 91,000 votes. Every Tom, Dick, and Harry that came in the office says, oh, you know, my group was the group that put you over the top, you know. And by the same token is that when you lose an election, any group you didn't do better in, you're going to say we should do that. So clearly, we have to do a lot better in attracting minorities to the Republican Party. I think we have to do better with young people. We did do a lot better with young people, just not well enough. I think we took a big toll on Obama's lead with people under 30 this time.
Do you think that, again, was it the way you reached those folks, the messaging, the message? What was the problem there? What was the disconnect?
Well, I think there's two things. One is the party is always defined by your leaders. So, you know, Mitt Romney defines what the Republican Party is in the election, just, you know, the reality of it. And so he didn't have that great connection, unfortunately. He was seen to be aloof, and he seemed to be wealthy, and, you know, the Democrats did a good job of demonizing him, I think unfairly, but they did. So you have that problem. And so since he controls the message for the party, I mean, that's the message.
Well,
and so I think the message needs to be better.
Recently, the Republicans named the chairs in the House. They're all white males. Is that a problem?
Well, I don't think that's a problem per se. I mean, you know, obviously, Kathy McMorris Rogers is the number four leader in the House, and she's a woman from Spokane, Washington. So, you know, there are key women in the Republican leadership. Just the way seniority works, that they haven't gotten up to committee chairmanships at this point. But I think part of the problem is, you know, and I think we talked about it the last time I was on the Mattie Report, is that gerrymandering has been a disservice to particularly to Republicans, is it makes all the districts safe. That was one thing that Ken Mattie excelled at, was that he didn't stop at where Republicans were, but he went to every group. He went to Hispanic groups, he went to black groups, he went to labor groups. There was no group that he wasn't willing to reach out
to. There's no indication that gerrymandering had an effect in this election. It hurt Tea Party candidates in Illinois, but it helped them in Texas.
Not gerrymandering in the sense of where the district lines are, but gerrymandering in the sense that it made districts homogeneous, and therefore Republicans or Democrats didn't have to reach out to people that were different than them. And so that's the thing, that when we had more competitive districts, we had people that were more skilled at that. And I think we need to be more skilled at that.
Okay, when we get to come back, we'll talk about the Tea Party willingness to compromise and move the nation forward. That conversation in a moment. Welcome back. We're talking with Sal Russo, chief strategist for the Tea Party Express. It's been said that politics is the art of compromise. Ronald Reagan raised taxes and compromised on immigration. So, will the Tea Party compromise or hold fast to its positions? So let's talk first about spending in the federal deficit. Is the Tea Party open to new sources of additional revenue, or do they think that the budget has to be balanced specifically with spending cuts alone?
No, when you have a divided government, you have to compromise. I mean, the Tea Party Express compromised in the last lame duck session. You know, we supported the Obama tax bill. Not all the Tea Party groups did, but we did.
And being specific about that, that was?
It extended the Bush tax cuts for 2 years. It had the payroll tax holiday, extended unemployment benefits. And then as part of that was the continuing resolution, I think it was for 3 months, that kept spending levels basically at the current level. So we swallowed a lot of things that we didn't like in that bill in the interest of keeping tax rates low and trying to grow this economy.
One of the things you didn't like was the extension of unemployment insurance, because you thought that might impact the debt? Would that be a fair assessment?
Well, I mean, that was one of the factors. We were willing to extend it beyond what it should have been, but you know, it's all in the interest of putting something together that you can live with. And so getting the tax cuts, we thought, was the most important piece of that. So we gave up things, much like, as you said, you know, Reagan had to give up. He thought we needed to build the defense budget up so we can keep the Soviets at bay. And the only way he could do that was to agree to domestic spending, and he didn't like doing that. But you have to give and you have to give to get, and that's what he did.
Well, the other thing he did was immigration. So do you see the Tea Party moving on immigration reform, working toward a pathway to citizenship? Where do you see the Tea Party on that?
The Tea Party, you know, we've stayed exclusively in economic issues, so we don't have a stand in that. I mean, but obviously, you know, not addressing the issue is silly. It needs to be addressed. There needs to be a comprehensive reform. But we stay focused on the economic issues. And to get to your, you know, really the key question that you asked was, can we get our budget under control with cuts alone? Absolutely not. There's no way you can do that. The only way we can get our way out of this is to be responsible in spending, and we have to have pro-growth policies in Washington.
But when you say that, are you talking about being revenue neutral, or are you talking about additional revenue?
I'm saying that you have to keep tax rates low. You know, we've already learned that. President Kennedy learned that. President Reagan learned that. President Clinton learned that, that when you keep tax rates low, you get more revenue.
But tax rates, weren't they higher under Clinton than they were under Bush? And we've had the Bush tax cuts for 10 years, yet the economy has faltered.
Yes, but if you look from 2000 and 2000 to 2007, which is the last data the IRS has, with the Bush tax cuts, I think revenues are up, I can't remember now, it's like 64% or something like that. It's gone from 100 and something trillion to 200 and something trillion. So it's brought more
revenue. It's just
that
expenses are up a lot more, too.
Yes, it's spending. It's what we've been saying all along. The spending is what's excessive. So we do need to do something about excessive spending for sure. But most importantly, I think you have to have pro-growth policies. The way to do that is to, I mean, I think ideally the way to do that is junk the tax code and go to a flat tax. I think that's the best idea. I mean, I'd be willing to accept a fair tax, but one thing you've got to do is you've got to get rid of all the loopholes in the tax code, because anybody who's wealthy has the lawyers and accountants that get themselves out of things, and that's where we have a lot of problems.
Let me transition to another issue that's a big issue, and that's the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare. One of the main goals of the Tea Party was to see that repealed. That appears unlikely. So now what's the next move?
Well, I don't think it's unlikely. It's still one of our goals. I mean, you know, they're having problems with the exchanges. I think something like almost 20 governors have now rejected creating the exchanges. I think there's a lot of issues still with Obamacare. I don't think it works ultimately, and I know some people know it's not going to work and want to go to a single-payer system. I hope when they realize it doesn't work, we can get rid of it and actually improve our private health care system.
Let me ask you about the tenor and tone of the debate. The use of hyperbole, you hear words like socialist, radical, traitor, racist. Does that have to be toned down a little bit? I mean, how do you negotiate a resolution or an agreement with folks that you're demonizing?
I certainly agree with that. I mean, I think the rhetoric's too heated. I think it's more excessive on the left than on the right, but certainly there are people on our side that violate it. And as sometimes somebody points out to me, I might get carried away even once in a while and say something. But I try not to, because it's not constructive.
You've been very well behaved here. I want to thank you for that. Well, listen, when we come back, we'll talk about the long-term future of the Tea Party movement. That conversation in a moment. Welcome back. We're talking with Sal Russo, chief strategist with the Tea Party Express. So what's the future role of the Tea Party in the Republican Party?
Well, you know, the Tea Party, to be successful, I've always felt, has to be strong in both political parties. The problem is, as long as you have Obama as president and the Democrats are, you know, pushing bigger spending, stimulus,
but there are conservative Democrats, you know, in some of those borderline states.
There are some. There are not many, and many of them told me that they just can't speak out. they can't speak out in the Democratic caucus on spending restraint. But to be successful, we have to do that. We have to turn the corner, because Americans, whether you're liberal or conservative, when I talk to people, well, it doesn't matter what their ideology or party is privately. They all tell me the spending's way out of control. The debt's way out of control. We've got to do something about it. Everybody acknowledges that. But you get in the political arena and we can't seem to solve the problem.
But one of the arguments, though, that the other side would say is, yes, spending is high now because we're in a recession, unemployment insurance had to be extended, et cetera, and that's why we're, and revenue receipts are down, therefore, big deficit. and as things get better, we'll begin to pull out of that. I mean, do you buy that argument?
The economy is dynamic enough that sometimes, despite what government does, you're going to go through the business cycle. But what we're seeing is 1% and 2% growth out of a recession, which we've never seen anything like that. We should be at 4% and 5% growth. And part of the problem with that, and the reason we have such low growth, is because we have too much of a tax burden, too much of a regulatory burden, and we're spending too much. The debt's unsustainable. And so you suck all that money out of the economy, and you don't have the growth. Well, and now you're talking about, as Obama's saying, is to not extend the tax cuts on the top wage earners. Well, that money is the money that isn't money that goes to people that are rich. It goes to people that are trying to become rich. Warren Buffett makes $1 a year. He isn't affected by that. So
but there was a controversial CBO report that was released and then not released that said that actually no, that the top income earners, if you increase their tax burden, it really isn't going to have much of an impact in terms of economic activity.
I saw Warren Buffett say that. I certainly disagree with that. I remember that was one of Ronald Reagan's stories that he used to tell when he was in Hollywood. Of course, by then the tax rate, I think, was 91%. And he said at the end of the year, he always declined doing the movie. He said, why am I going to do the movie for 10%?
That was under a Republican president, Eisenhower.
That's right. That's right.
Let's talk about this whole debate about social conservatism versus fiscal conservatism. It sounds like the Tea Party Express is falling down on the line of fiscal conservatism, not really getting involved with the social conservatism part of the Republican Party. Can the Republican Party do both, or do they have to kind of pick a side?
I think that we've had in this country basically a conservative-liberal divide, since the late 50s and early 60s. And for the Republican Party to be a majority party, it has to have economic, foreign policy, and social conservatives. I mean, I think that's essential to be the coalition. Now, we focus only on economic issues because at this point in time in our history, I think that's the most important thing, and we can rally a majority of people on our issues at this point in time.
So you're not agreeing with the argument that some pundits have said that, on the social issues, the Republican Party's positions are driving away single women, Latinos, younger voters?
I think there's a harshness to the social conservative message today that we need to get rid of. I mean, I think what we're seeing is young people, even those that are conservative, are much less judgmental. I know Reagan's answer always used to be, let's leave that to the man upstairs. That was kind of his standard reply. And I think we have to probably be more tolerant on social issues than we've been and accept people with different viewpoints to be a majority party. But I don't think that means you deviate from the conservative base of the party.
What if the economy actually improves? Does that take the steam out of the Tea Party movement?
Sure, when the economy gets better, then people are less concerned. But I think what we're going to find is under the Obama policies, the economy is never going to get much better. We're going to be stuck in the 1-2% growth rate, and thanks to Europe, we may actually dip into another recession. So I don't think the next 2 years are going to be positive.
Who should pick the candidates? Should the Republican Party officials be picking the candidates to avoid what they're saying are unelectable folks? Or should it be a grassroots movement of conservatives that select them? In other words, should we make the primary contests, should we emphasize them or de-emphasize primaries?
Well, I think you always want to put confidence in voters. I just came back to Eastern Europe and was listening to horror stories of people telling me what it was like under communism when you give absolute power to people. It goes bad. So, you're much better off giving people the power, even though they make bad decisions. This last election, there were a lot of bad decisions. California, as far as I'm concerned. But I'd rather have the people doing it.
I disagree with you on that.
That's right, they do. But I'd rather have the people make decisions than the political insiders.
What about this tension between the Tea Party wing and the traditional wing of the Republican Party? Are they going to keep fighting, or is one side going to try to co-opt the other? What's going to happen in 2014, let's say, the 2014 elections?
Well, I think the Senate Campaign Committee, the Republican Senate Committee, put Ted Cruz as one of the co-chairmen of the committee. So
he's a Tea Party favorite.
And he's a Tea Party favorite. So I think that there's a desire for cooperation by everybody. But we're not going to support candidates that want to go out there and raise taxes. Not because there's some magic, as I keep pointing out. The Bush tax cuts are not in the Tenth Commandments. I looked. It's not in there. So, it's not like it's magic. But what is magic is that if we create a bad economic environment, That doesn't affect rich people. They're already rich. It affects poor people. It affects middle class people. That's what we don't want to do. We don't want to create an environment where people can't get out of the bad economic situation they're in. And on that, we're uncompromising.
Well, I want to thank Sal Russo, Chief Strategist with the Tea Party Express, for joining us. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can sign up for our award-winning e-newsletter, The Mattie Daily, by logging on to our website at mattieinstitute.org.
Up next, will the Tea Party continue to be a political force in Washington and the San Joaquin Valley? We'll get a Valley perspective from Mike Malines, former Republican State Assembly Minority Leader, Justin Stoner, District Director for the current Republican Minority Leader Connie Conway, and Paul Hurley, former editorial page editor with the Visalia Times Delta.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Mattie Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. The Tea Party has been a force in national and local politics for several years. What does the future hold for the Tea Party movement? We're joined by three observers of national and Valley politics. They are Mike Malines, former Republican State Assembly Minority Leader, Justin Stoner, District Director for the current Republican Minority Leader, Connie Conway, and Paul Hurley, former editorial page editor with the Visalia Times Delta. Welcome to all of you. Let's get started, Mike, with you. You know, Sal Russo mentioned that for a populist movement to be successful, it's going to have Republicans, Democrats, and independents. But doesn't it seem that the Tea Party has supported few, if any, Democrats, even conservative Democrats? So is the Tea Party really a bipartisan movement, or have they simply morphed into the conservative wing of the Republican Party?
Well, I think they started out as a bipartisan organization focused on fiscal issues. And what happened is I think it slowly started to become viewed as and then maybe became a Republican organization almost. And I think that its great success was when it was much broader. And so I think they're going to have to sort of come back to that. And everything that I'm reading and hearing and seeing is that that's exactly what they're going to do, is focus on the fiscal issues that matter to independents, you know, Democrats and Republicans. And that will be their success going forward if they can. And I think if they don't, then they're going to be sort of relegated to a Republican organization, which in California has, you know, isn't the greatest position to be in right now.
Paul, what do you think?
I think it's going to be very hard for the Tea Party to appeal to Democrats. And vice versa, because the Democrats demonized the Tea Party members quite severely when they first started out. And there was a lot of antagonism there on both sides. A lot of Democrats saw the Tea Party as quasi-racist, opposing the president, and just nothing but kind of a negative response to the administration. And on the other hand, the Tea Party is not has not seen anything, certainly from the Democrats, that's welcoming. So I think it's going to be very difficult for those two groups to align themselves in any way, even on fiscal policies.
Justin, what do you think?
Well, I agree with Mike. I think that the bipartisan appeal was there at the beginning, and it has been lost along the way. I think they need to moderate their tone going forward. That bipartisan appeal can be there with the fiscal conservatism, that holding the feet to the fire. But they need to find a way to sit down with the Democrats and independents and find some common ground. And so they're going to need to spend some time doing some outreach to them.
Yeah, you know, Sal seemed to mention that the focus of the Tea Party movement is toward economic and fiscal conservatism and away from social conservatism. I'm just wondering, will that create a tension within the Republican Party as the more libertarian Tea Party folks clash with the social conservatives who want to do things like ban gay marriage and abortion, Paul?
I think you're going to see the Republicans sort of back away from a lot of those issues. They seem to be a lot more focused, and they're trying to direct the agenda toward reform of government, toward the reform of the tax structure, fiscal conservatism. So probably this is a riper time than any other for that transformation to take place.
What do you think, Justin?
Yeah, that tension already exists within the Republican Party. Paul's right when he says that they're moving away from that, focusing on the fiscal issues, the issues of governance. You know, the issue when it comes to the Tea Party is, for them, will the real Tea Party please stand up? I get emails from four different national Tea Party groups, and they're all in a different message.
Yeah, that's true. There are these different groups. You don't know which group is really controlling the message.
Exactly.
Yeah, Mike, what do you think?
Well, I think that's a really good point that Justin made, and I'm in agreement with really what they both said. And I would just expand a little and say that the more that the Tea Party focuses on, you call them what you want, but they're fiscal issues and away from the social issues, because, you know, Justin hit it right. Within the Republican Party, we already have that split. You know, I don't know if it's a split, but we already have that debate at every convention, in every state and across the country, between sort of social conservatives, social moderates, fiscal conservatives, fiscal moderates. But the Tea Party, their success, I think, only comes when they're not just, you know, on fiscal issues with Republicans, but they're appealing to the broadest growing group, at least in California. I haven't looked at national standards. Independents. The independents care about fiscal issues and do not want to be bothered. I know many of these people about the social stuff. And I think that's where that's their challenge, and that's where their success will come from, like I said earlier, if they can appeal to that. And my recollection is, and it's the same thing, I get so many emails that are, you know, across the country, different, you know, groups that are all quote unquote Tea Party are very different. But if they focus on the fiscal issues, it is ripe timing with, you know, the national debate that's going to occur. And it allows them to, I think, kind of crystallize who they are. So it's actually a great opportunity for them if they can do that.
Paul, you wanted to say something?
There's another issue that the Tea Party can capitalize on, and that is their desire for smaller government, less
yes.
regulation, more business-friendly climates, especially among independents and especially in this valley. So if they can emphasize that, they should be able to make some gains among declined states.
You know, Justin, the Tea Party seems to be focusing more on fiscal conservatism. But, you know, it was strangely quiet during the fiscal cliff debate. And some argued that the Tea Party actually helped bring the country to that moment. The automatic spending cuts at the heart of the year-end fiscal cliff grew out of the Tea Party's fierce campaign last year to slash federal budgets and to cap government borrowing. Yet there were no Tea Party rallies this time around. They seem to be unusually quiet. Why is that?
Well, you know, even Al Sharpton has to put the bullhorn down sometimes.
I don't know if you want to equate Al Sharpton and the Tea Party movement, but
the point I'm making, though, is that at some point you realize you're making a lot of noise and people have tuned you out. And you even heard that from their leaders. They were saying, as the fiscal cliff was starting to gain traction in the media, that they're not listening to us. And so I think now, you know, they're trying to get that seat at the table so that they can negotiate, they can press these issues without the big rallies, because big rallies, loud noise, a lot of rhetoric isn't, you know, peddling their influence the way they'd like to do that.
Mike, what do you think? Why were they so quiet during the cliff negotiations?
I think part of it was what Justin brought up earlier, is that I think that they became there was no one compelling message for the Tea Party. And so you couldn't go into the cliff, you know, the fiscal cliff debate saying we're the Tea Party for smaller government, less spending and less taxes. They had become a lot more coming out of this brutal election. And frankly, Republicans and Tea Party, even though there's some individual, you know, congressional members went through, I think, suffered. I mean, it was not a good election for them. So I think they positioned themselves not well for the cliff debate, but that I think they have every opportunity, as Paul said earlier, to be positioned well going into the future debates on these.
Well, you know, you could argue, though, that they did have some influence when Boehner tried to come up with its plan B. The Tea Party folks in Congress said, no way. So they did have influence, just wasn't the rallies.
Yeah, and in terms of being, you know, very public and out there, right, individual members, yes. And I think you do see a little more conservative Congress. So I think that is true. But they didn't have, like you said, the rallies, the public perception, because I think they're stratified. I think they're not organized like they were 4 years ago, 2 years ago. It just has become split. So it was harder to do.
Paul, what do you think?
I suspect that a lot of the Tea Party members were hoping that the nation would go over the fiscal cliff, and I hate that metaphor, and it's really not a cliff, but
right.
that there wouldn't be a compromise, that there wouldn't be any legislation that would be stuck, and that they would be able to come forward with a plan. Because it was kind of strange that they didn't really have much of any points to make during the debate.
You know, Mike, you kind of were echoing what Sal Russo said earlier, that we may even see a more conservative Congress in 2013. So does that mean we're likely to see a game of chicken similar to the 2010 debt ceiling debate replayed this spring in the upcoming debate over the debt ceiling and sequestration?
I do. I mean, I think we just saw the replay of it. Now, apparently, the wisdom was that we'll do it in 2 months from now again. So you're going to see a third version of it.
So lots of these mini cliffs.
Yeah, Yeah, and I think that's bad for the country, and I just frankly think it's bad for Congress as well, for both parties. I think that, you know, everybody in there wants to get something done, and they need to, you know, just kind of get together and decide how are we going to be able to pull this off, and, you know, both are going to have to take a little bit of a bitter pill. Yes, I do think it's a more conservative Congress in general, but I think even if it was more liberal or less conservative, however you want to say it, we'd still have this partisan divide. It's bigger than just it's bigger than just the parties now. It's becoming, you know, broader into so many areas, and that's a problem for the country that those men and women are going to have to struggle with to figure out, when do we put country first. At some point, they're going to have to get there. The fiscal issues are also national security issues, are, you know, food processing. I mean, there is everything across that matters to every American these issues fall into. And so hopefully they'll be able to get to treat it like a business deal, and then we'll be better off.
You know, it seems like a lot of times the discussion is, you know, flabby pragmatism versus, you know, courageous idealism. So, Paul, you know, what's going to happen here? Is Congress going to be able to actually work together and get something done?
No. That's a short answer. You know, I think I mentioned before that Congress sort of did business as usual with the deal that they made at the end of the year, beginning of January, and I think they're going to probably fall back into their same positions as we approach the debt ceiling and the sequestration debates, and that we'll see kind of more of the same. It's going to be fanned by the media. You're going to have a few people step in there and take some positions and try to be the white knight. But unfortunately, I'm kind of pessimistic that we won't see a lot more of the same with the debates coming in the next 2 months.
Justin, what do you think?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think, you know, Congress is really just a reflection of culture, in the sense that we expect our elected leaders to be bipartisan, to work together, to work out a deal. But even in our own private lives, a lot of times we are not bipartisan. We,
you know, that's a good point, because the country is fractured. I mean, the country is evenly divided.
Yeah.
And so that's not surprising, is it, that Congress behaves that way?
Yeah, it's not surprising. And, you know, as a culture, as a society, we need to expect more. We need to expect better. But we have to take that to our own leaders and, you know, get that message across.
You know, I want to ask you, Justin, you know, about what Sal commented about, and that is the concern about some of these losses. Though there weren't that many, actually. The Tea Party won 67 seats in 2010. They didn't lose that many this time around. What is interesting that the Cook Political Report said that Democratic candidates won more than 1.1 million more votes than Republicans, making it one of the handful of elections in the last 100 years where a party that won the popular vote did not win control of the House. So the question is, what's going on here? What explains it? Is it gerrymandered districts? Is it the power of incumbency? Is it something else?
Well, I think, you know, what it does is demonstrate just how effectively President Obama energized and turned out his base compared to the lackluster turnout for Republicans. You know, you could make the argument that redistricting was a factor in some states and some areas, and that's always going to be an issue and always going to be a problem. But I think he just did a better job targeting his voters and getting them out.
Mike, what do you think?
I think I echo the same thing. I mean, the president did an incredible job, as we're all starting to peel back the onion and see more and more each week, of getting out their vote. Of the way they set the election up and the way they stayed the course was an incredible victory when you just look at the science of running a campaign. What they did is they just powered the vote in congressional and assembly and Senate districts across the country. Well, they were able to just have so many more Democrats voting than Republicans. That's why they had it. You know, it doesn't change it by – Fresno was going to go the way Fresno was going to go, San Francisco the way it was going to go. But San Francisco had more people voting percentage-wise than other places because they were very motivated to vote.
Okay, so you're saying basically that, yes, more people voted for Democratic candidates, but they were in those areas that are already heavily Democratic?
Correct.
Paul, what do you think?
Well, I had a little different perspective on that. Let's presume, first of all, that more and more people are turning away from both political parties, that independent voters, or declined to stay, as they call them here in California, are on the rise, and that they are drawing membership from both Democrats and Republicans. So let's presume that is happening. In a number of congressional races, you had candidates as Republicans who were Tea Party candidates and were rather extreme in either their positions, their rhetorics, or in particular things that they said, especially on social issues. That drew the independents toward the Democratic candidates. And that's an explanation for why the Tea Party didn't do better and also why so many votes went to Democrats in this past election.
Okay, well, when we come back, we'll talk about the local impact of the Tea Party movement. That conversation in a moment. This is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition.
From News Talk 580 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Here is Mark Kepler.
Welcome back. They say that all politics are local. So what role is or will the Tea Party play in local Valley politics? We're talking to Mike Valines, former Republican State Assembly Minority Leader, Paul Hurley, former editorial page editor with Visalia Times-Delta, and Justin Stoner, District Director for the current Republican Minority Leader, Connie Conway. So, Justin, let me ask you, the Republican Party is really taking it on the chin in California these days. Today, fewer than 30% of the state's registered voters are Republicans. In L.A. County, it's particularly dire for the Republicans because they're now third behind Democrats and independents. So how does the Tea Party message of smaller government and balanced budgets differ from the traditional Republican Party message? And can that be a blueprint for the future resurgence of the Republican Party in California?
Yeah, and the messages sound the same from both in the sense that they want smaller government and balanced budget. The difference, I would say, is that the Republicans, they bring a plan to the table to accomplish that. The Tea Party, if you look at their principles, their mission statements, they start with words like no, reduce, stop, repeal, cease. But there's no actual action items. There's no plan to back it up. And so simply stating no, that's not public policy. That's not a plan. And the Republicans bring a plan for the initiatives that they are advancing in terms of smaller government and, economic conservatism.
Oh, Mike, what about the Tea Party? Do they have a blueprint for helping the Republican Party gain back a foothold in California?
Well, I don't think they have a blueprint for the Republican Party that they're putting forward to say, hey, Republicans, you should pay attention to this. But I think the Tea Party's blueprint is the biggest benefit to the Republican Party. It is inherently whereas Republicans we have sort of been, which is, fiscal issues, business issues, and not business in the sense of big business, but, small business, things like that. It's traditionally been where Republicans have been. The more that they'll stay focused on fiscal issues nationally and in the state, we'll have a chance to grow. It's when we get outside of those issues and get viewed as a lot of the social conservatism and other issues where we really start having splits, I think. So I actually think in a reverse way, the Republicans can benefit from the Tea Party message. But Justin said it. There has to be a plan behind that that people believe. And that's tough to get that message out. That's Republicans' challenge. But on the flip side of that, I think the Tea Party has to be careful not to become a Republican proxy or else, the only reason they have – no, that's not the right way to say it. Their best value, I believe, is to people who are disaffected with Republicans and Democrats, and that huge decline to state/independent population has to really be the base that they pursue, I think.
Couldn't you argue, though, they could kind of be the counterweight to unions for the Democratic Party? The unions are very effective at getting the ground game together, getting the vote out, that the Tea Party movement has kind of energized Republicans and conservatives to kind of get out and vote. Couldn't they play a role that way?
I think so. I mean, I that would help Republicans, but I just don't know how organized they've been. I haven't seen the data from across the country or in the state how they really were able to do that outside of targeted races where they get involved. So I just don't know. It's a much broader issue the Republicans have to tackle with about getting out the vote and appealing to voters.
So Paul, what do you think?
Well, Justin and Mike both made good points, especially about the fact that Tea Party doesn't seem to have specific plans to execute their principles. They're very big on principles. But, the man on the street, the voter at the ballot box, doesn't care so much about principles. He cares about what's happening to his life or her life.
Right.
Tea Party has to, and the Republican Party, they have to articulate ways in which their programs are going to help individual people have a better life. And they've also got to appeal to a lot of constituencies that they've either ignored or antagonized in the past.
I'm going to ask Mike about some local Valley elections. I mean, did the Tea Party play any role in Valley politics this year?
I think they did. I mean, I think there are two races that you can take a look at, and I don't. I mean, I think these candidates won on their own. I think they did. They worked very hard. They were out walking. I think one was a little surprised and one wasn't. But if you look at Supervisor Farinelli in Madera, I think that the prevailing wisdom was is that he probably wasn't going to win. He did. If you look at Steve Brandow, I think prevailing wisdom was that Steve Brandow on the Fresno City Council was going to win, but it was close. Both of those gentlemen are closely aligned with the Tea Party. Both had volunteers and a lot of activity from those parties out helping them. And I would argue in the case of Farinelli that that kind of came out of nowhere. Not nowhere, because he's a known commodity as a business guy in Madera. But I think that the Tea Party and their volunteers did have an impact in those two races. And I think that that's actually a model for Republicans to look at, to where can you marry bringing in, and I know this isn't just about Republicans, but where do you bring them in to be helpful? Those two gentlemen did a really good job of doing that. And I think that's, to me, two examples locally where they did have a big impact.
Yeah, it seems to make sense that the Tea Party is a grassroots movement, that they're going to have some impact in local elections. I want to ask, switching here gears a little bit, about Hispanics. Obviously, a big and growing part of the electorate. Nowhere is that more true, obviously, than the San Joaquin Valley. But do you think the Tea Party message of fiscal conservatism is going to resonate with Hispanics? And will it overcome the perception among some that the Tea Party is anti-immigrant, for example, their opposition to the DREAM Act? What do you think, Paul?
They ought to not say anything about their opposition to the DREAM Act, basically. Just stay away from that. They could have a great appeal to the Hispanic voting bloc. These are families. These are people who are starting or owning their own business. There's a lot of the Tea Party principles that would apply to the Hispanic population. As I said before, they have to articulate it to that constituency to demonstrate to them how it would best benefit them. But if they really put their mind to it and tried to capitalize on that, there would be great opportunity for the Tea Party to basically have very strong Hispanic support.
Mike, what do you think? Do you think the Tea Party can engage Hispanics?
Well, I think this is, it's interesting because I think this really dovetails closely with Republicans. Just in general, I think the Tea Party, absolutely, Paul's right. They should. There's no reason to be involved in the DREAM Act. If they're talking about getting involved in fiscal issues, yes, you can say the DREAM Act, you're funding, funding individuals who wouldn't otherwise. But let's just state a core fiscal issues. They can have a bigger impact. But the follow-up question, can they do that with sort of the perception out there of people about being anti-immigrant? I think that's going to take a cycle or two of proof to Hispanic communities and others that they're focused on fiscal issues, small business issues, bread and butter American issues. Then they'll have appeal. But, for fair or not, there is this perception that they're anti-immigrant, and that's going to be tough for them to get past. But their challenge and the Republican challenge on that one is the same.
Okay. Well, Justin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that fiscal conservatism already appeals to the Hispanic community.
Right.
Like Paul said, they are very family-oriented. But, they tune out the Tea Party. They tune out the Republicans when we start talking about deporting grandma. So, we are losing them by some of the other issues that we take up and that we are really fighting for. I think it's a mystery to a lot of Republicans. They think, gosh, these people are very pro-family, very pro-business. They're very conservative on a lot of social issues. Why aren't
they're
they
pro-life,
voting with us?
Too,
Yeah, pro-life. Why aren't they voting with us? Well, when you tell them you're going to deport members of their family, we don't look like the pro-family party anymore.
Well, let me talk about, the Tea Party as it relates to Valley legislative districts. Some of these districts are pretty heavily concentrated Republican. Does that give the Tea Party more leverage because it can threaten a primary challenge to Republicans? What do you think, Paul?
It does give them more opportunities to run rather as independent parties. In California, the party system with the top two primary system now, the designation of political parties is becoming less and less distinct. And the Tea Party has some opportunity to get some candidates on the ballot and, to challenge incumbents. That's going to be very difficult, though, because the legislators that are serving in the Valley are very strong. They'd be very difficult to unseat. And Any of the serving lawmakers in the Valley now could easily withstand a Tea Party challenge, so I'm not so sure they'd be able to make that great an inroad.
Justin, what do you think?
Yeah, I think the open primaries do present an opportunity, but not necessarily for the extremes of either party, but people more in the center who could appeal to both Republicans and Democrats.
Okay, we've only got a short time left here in the segment. I just wanted to ask you about this. We talked about with Sal Russo about this use of hyperbole, the kind of the exaggerated loaded terms like socialist, radical, traitor, racist, and how that might undermine the ability to reach agreement with folks you're demonizing. So what do you think? Is hyperbole getting in the way of getting something done? What do you think, Mike?
Well, you know, there's always a role for hyperbole in terms of, you know, claiming your position and advocating for it and being strong. But I always use the term when you're behind the door, when the door's closed and you're negotiating, you can't be like that. Now, having said that, hyperbole shouldn't be as negative as the terms that you were just using. We've gotten way too negative, way too personal, although it's always been that way. We've talked about this in other shows. Go back to the Adams-Jefferson's elections. All you have to see is that what we do today is nothing compared to what they were doing. So it's a problem, though. Because
so we're bad, but they were worse?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But I mean, that doesn't sound very good either, right? But I guess the point I'd make is I do feel as somebody who was elected and who observes from the outside now, the level of negative, you know, speak to each other out in the public, it does make it hard to sit down and get things done. It creates this level of distrust that you have to break through an extra step. And that's not good for California, and it's not good for the country. Strong disagreements should happen, and there should be a way to professionally do that and you know, still be responsible. Somehow we've crossed away from that.
Hopefully that'll happen. I want to thank our guests. We've run out of time. I want to thank Mike Valiens, former Republican State Assembly Minority Leader, Justin Stoner, District Director for the current Republican Minority Leader, Connie Conway, and Paul Hurley, former editorial page editor with Visalia Times Delta. If you want to stay current with state and local politics, you can sign up for our award-winning e-newsletter, The Mattie Daily, just by logging on to our website at mattieinstitute.org.
The Mattie Report Valley Views Edition is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio and the nonpartisan Mattie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on important public policy issues.
This is Mark Kepler for the Mattie Report Valley Views Edition. Thanks for joining us.